I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief.
That's former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan in his opening remarks to the House Oversight and Reform Committee today. Here's a later exchange with Committee Chair Henry Waxman, asking whether Greenspan now thinks that his ideology of unregulated free markets was mistaken.
What I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. It was
not working.
Greenspan also said he can't see avoiding a significant rise in layoffs and unemployment, and that it will take months and months for the housing market to stabilize. Well, meanwhile, more help might be on the way for the 7 million Americans expected to default on their mortgages in the next 2 years. The Treasury Department is considering a new plan to spend $40 billion to get banks and mortgage servicers to renegotiate bad loans. That plan was floated today at another hearing on Capitol Hill. Joining us from Washington is Damian Paletta, Wall Street Journal reporter. He first reported the story of this new plan this morning. Damian, boy, a lot going on in Washington. Stunning comments, I think, from Alan Greenspan. We'll get to those in a minute. But this new homeowner help program, how would it work?
It's interesting that it's still in the development stages and a lot of things could change. But I think the idea is for the government to give a financial incentive to lenders to say, hey, if you rework this loan into certain terms, affordable terms for borrowers, and they meet our criteria, then we will agree to enter into a partial loss sharing agreement with you so that if this new affordable loan, if the borrower defaults on that loan in the future, we will agree for a set period of time to take a bit of the loss with you so you won't be shouldering the entire loss yourself.
So they don't get the money until after a loan defaults and in the event that it does.
That's right. I mean, It's possible the government couldn't be out any money if all these loans are reworked into more affordable loans. But I think the idea is to sort of try to take some of the risk off the servicer. They won't be paying off the servicers to make these changes. They'll just be offering the incentive that, you know, you won't the subprime loans now, if they go bad, the banks take all the hit.
Right.
But the government will agree to shoulder some of that loss in the future for a better loan.
Right, so renegotiate and at least get some money. Separately, the government could still directly buy up troubled mortgages under the $700 billion bailout plan. Is that taking place?
That's right. They're working on the plans right now. They're trying to pick asset managers and people to oversee and manage those loans. So that's already in the works. It's going to be pretty complicated and pretty massive in scale. But it is pretty tricky because a lot of these loans, we all know, are sliced and diced into securities, and there isn't necessarily one owner of a loan. So that plan could face some hurdles going forward. And also, of course, they've never tried anything like this on such a scale. Who knows how successful it'll be?
Okay, just to Alan Greenspan and the comments that seem to be saying, gee, my view of the world and the economy was wrong. Your thoughts on what you heard from him today?
I found that pretty remarkable. We saw earlier this year, you know, he last year even, when his memoir came out, he was really defensive in trying to, you know, defend his legacy as chairman of the Fed for so long. Today we heard some pretty sobering statements out of him, you know, admitting some mistakes that he made and that his whole sort of regulatory philosophy was wrong. This is something he's been under heavy criticism for and something that his successor, Ben Bernanke, has been trying to deal with the aftermath of for a while. But I think it was pretty remarkable to see the former Fed chairman, who we've all seen on Capitol Hill for so many years, make statements like that.
Sobering statements. And just briefly, Damian, his prognosis that it might take the housing market months and months to stabilize, is that a rosy view or is that realistic?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be at least months and months. I mean, I think we're, you know, a lot of people think probably 2010 at the earliest will we come back to any sort of normalcy. But, you know, the other thing he said was the unemployment, the layoffs, the drop in consumer spending, that's all going to put a terrible squeeze on the economy. And all that stuff together is going to make it really hard for us to regain our footing in the short term.
Damian Paletta, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, on two pretty extraordinary hearings today in Washington on the economy. Damian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, to politics, briefly, Republican presidential candidate John McCain is taking his Joe the Plumber message to blue-collar voters in Florida today. And Democratic candidate Barack Obama heads to Hawaii after a rally in Indiana this morning. Obama is going to visit the ailing grandmother who helped raise him and who is white. Remember, Obama once said, "She was a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed by her on the street." Well, that reminds us of the fierce debate in some corners when Obama first announced his candidacy as to whether or not he was black enough. But recent reporting has raised another point of view on race that we thought was worth taking a look at today. The view that Obama, the son of a white woman from Kansas and a black man from Kenya, is not black or white. He is the other. In the New York Times recently, an Alabama man named Ricky Thompson put it this way: Obama's neither nor. He's other. It's in the Bible. Come as one. Don't create other breeds. K. Anthony Appiah teaches philosophy at Princeton. He's author of a number of books, including The Ethics of Identity. We thought we'd invite him in for this conversation on mixed race identity. And Anthony joins us from the Carnegie Hall studios in New York. Welcome.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We should say at the top, you are an Obama supporter, but also you were born in London, raised in Ghana, your father a Ghanaian politician, Joe Appiah, your mother the white children's book author, Peggy Cripps. So you know a thing or two about mixed race.
We've continued it in the next generation. My sisters are married to a Nigerian and a Norwegian, and my younger sister's married people of every possible hue several times.
Well, how common is the thinking that it's actually driven by the Bible, that mixed-race people are the other?
Well, I think that that used to be a commoner point of view. I mean, a lot of religious taboos are about mixing things that people think shouldn't be mixed. Mm. But I don't think it's terribly easy to make sense of what Americans have thought about race without pointing out that most of the people that count as black in this country have some European ancestry. And furthermore, that many people who count as white in this country have some African ancestry. But the point is, there are lots of people who don't think of themselves as mixed race who are, by American standards, of mixed race. And on the other hand, there are people who know that they're, by American standards, of mixed race because they have two current parents who are classified differently in the American racial classification system. Now, in the old days, if you had one black parent, you were black, basically, unless you could pass. Passing meant that you were hiding the fact that you were black.
Well, we're getting a glimpse into that past through some of these people who were very open in the New York Times, and you know, I'm thankful for it because, you know, we get to hear that in pockets of the country this is still viewed as something foreign and other, and even through a religious prism. There were other people quoted in the New York Times article. Glenn Reynolds says, "God taught the children of Israel not to intermarry. It's wrong." But on the other hand, there was another older man, Bud Rowell, who said he was once very much against blacks. He was once arrested for throwing firecrackers in a black section of town. But now he has three biracial grandkids. And he says, "It was rough on me, but now I see they were human too." So it feels as if there's almost a role for people of mixed race.
I think that it is hardest to keep your prejudices when they are undermined by natural family feeling. And so the more people there are who are marrying across what in America are regarded as race lines, the harder it is to maintain those prejudices.
Yeah. Still, I'm just wondering, as someone of mixed race, how do you respond to reading those very frank words from people you might run across someday? I mean, how does that feel, read that?
What I mostly feel is sort of sad that people have been drawn by an old ideology which comes from slavery times into thinking in these ways. And the idea that there is such a thing, I think, as a pure race is a sort of fantasy.
Do you think that the McCain campaign, as some have said, has fed into even a subconscious sense of someone of mixed race being the other by language that's being used on the campaign trail?
I think the real thing they're doing is drawing attention to one way in which Barack Obama is unusual or strange in the United States context, which is that he's a person with a dark skin, a person who looks as though he has African ancestry and has African ancestry, who doesn't behave in the stereotypical ways that in which people think that black people ought to behave in this country. Now, I think many people have stereotypes of black people which make Barack Obama somewhat refreshing. because they have a notion of how black people ought to behave, which they find makes them a little bit uneasy, maybe feel a little bit guilty.
Underscoring again that it's a stereotype that they have.
Yeah, right. They have a stereotype. All of our social identities come not just with ideas about how you define the boundary between the women and the men, or the blacks and the whites, or the gays and the straights, but also with ideas about how people of the various kinds ought to behave. When I get up in the morning, I don't entertain the thought that I should put on a dress, because I think of myself as a man, and there's a norm in our society that men don't wear dresses, so I just don't even think about it as an option. Similarly, there are notions about how black people ought to speak, how they ought to behave. And when people, both black and white in this country, have been arguing about whether Obama is black enough or whether he's really black, part of what they're arguing about is whether he fits their notion of how black people ought to behave. And he doesn't fit the notions of many people about how black people ought to behave. In that sense, he is outside the sort of normal pattern in American life.
Well, some have said, you know, that's because not many Americans see images on television, for instance, of middle-class or upper-middle-class educated American blacks. They haven't since Bill Cosby, though if you go to Atlanta or, you know, several neighborhoods in Chicago, you see, of course, thousands of middle-class Americans. They're just not seeing them. But others have said that this aspect of Barack Obama, which again runs against a stereotype, is being wielded against him. Peter Beinart writes in Time magazine that, in fact, fear of race has been disguised as questions about exoticness, that Barack Obama is said to be cosmopolitan, exotic. Sarah Palin says Obama doesn't see America the way you and I do. Clinton strategist Mark Penn urged Hillary Clinton to exploit Obama's lack of American roots, that foreignness is the new racism.
I think there is a portion of our population that you can motivate in that way. But it's important to point out that this works in both directions. There are people who are attracted to Barack Obama because they think of him as something new. There's a black politician who is not terribly preoccupied with pushing a racial agenda. And so it's playing on both sides. And I think the idea that he's other just is the idea that there's something new and, for some people, exciting, and for other people, strange about him. His mixed race identity is part of what's attractive, because this is a way of saying, look, this is America too. America is not just the country that produced slavery and Jim Crow and then had to struggle through the civil rights movement. America is also this new country full of young people who are not even in their deepest moments tempted even slightly by racism.
Anthony Appiah teaches philosophy at Princeton. He's author of a number of books, including The Ethics of Identity. By the way, we mentioned Mark Penn's advice to Hillary Clinton to exploit Obama's lack of American roots. We should say she pointedly did not take that advice. And more, by the way, in the coming days, we're going to talk with parents in biracial families who are watching their kids choose an identity, something more and more American parents are witnessing, that story in the days ahead. But after the break, how Obama's mixed race sometimes can send a mixed message from Obama campaign workers out on the campaign trail. And later today, Sarah Palin, Washington outsider or savvy political strategist who wowed the old boy club right after she became governor in 2006. Fascinating story from reporter Jane Mayer. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation about racial identity with K. Anthony Appiah, professor of philosophy at Princeton. We were talking about a belief among some Americans that Barack Obama is neither black nor white, he's other. Anthony saying this can be turned in Obama's favor, but that's been controversial in at least one instance. Obama volunteer Kathy Vance was canvassing, going door to door, when she met a woman. Now, their exchange was transcribed in the New York Times. The woman said, "I've never been around black people. I just worry that they're nice to your face, but then when they get around to their own people, you just have to worry about what they're going to do to you." And Kathy, the Obama volunteer, said in return, "Well, you just have to remember Obama is half white, and he was raised by his white mother, so his views are more white than black, really." Well, Kathy got vilified on blogs for saying that, and she defended herself by saying that criticizing this woman wouldn't have helped this woman. But, Anthony, one can see black supporters of Barack Obama saying, "Well, wait a minute, you're, you know, get a vote at our expense."
This is a bit like the thing that Colin Powell responded to so beautifully the other day when he talked about, so what if he were a Muslim? He's not a Muslim, but so what if he were? Do you point out to people that it's a kind of weird, paranoid assumption that black people are hiding away in corners together saying nasty things about white people? Or do you say to them, look, the corner that he hides in has white people in it, so he can't be doing that. It wouldn't make any sense. You know, in the long run, you've got to persuade people of the first thing. You've got to persuade them that it's a sad way to think about your neighbours and your fellow countrymen. But in the short run, maybe it's more effective just to say what she said, which is, it doesn't seem very likely that someone who was raised by, who spent 9 months in the womb of a white woman and was then raised by her and her mother, it doesn't seem very likely that that person has sort of massive hostilities towards white people.
Yeah. How much is this revealing? Again, we've talked about different aspects of race that have been raised because of this historic candidacy. But just staying with the mixed race aspect, mm-hmm. which he represents, how much does it reveal to us about America? I mean, I'm thinking of the community that Barack Obama lives in, Hyde Park in Chicago, 43% white, 37% black, 11% Asian, 4% Hispanic. And meanwhile, we're, you know, hearing from these voters in areas where they have absolutely no interaction with someone of another color, much less mm-hmm. a mixed race. To them, that's still unimaginable.
Look, in many of those places, we should remember that there's been racial mixing all along. There's a kind of forgetting going on. There's a kind of erasure of memory, which we shouldn't allow to pass unnoticed. But it's important to remember, I think, that we're excited, at least some of us are, excited about the fact that Americans now pick their spouses by something other than just saying, oh, well, I have to marry a black person or I have to marry a white person because I'm black or white. But until recently, the rates of intermarriage between blacks and whites in this country were astonishingly low by global standards, so low that if it had been an animal population, biologists might have thought that they were different species that couldn't interbreed. Those numbers are coming up, and I think that's a sign of this change that's going on in our country. But, and as you say, many, many people in this country, both white and black, have very little interaction with people across the race line. I'm talking about black and white. I don't want to forget that we're not just black and white in this country, that we have people increasingly from East and South Asia, for example, who are in a different, who from our point of view, are in a different racial category.
Well, and then Hispanics. And you know, some have said that, speaking of mixed race, the new color in America isn't black or white, but brown.
Right. And it's one of the weird things about this country that we've taken people who have in common that they come from Latin American countries where the language is Spanish, or if you include Brazilians, Portuguese, and turned them into a race, even though the point about Latin America, like our own part of the continent, is that it was populated both from Africa and from Europe, and that those populations were laid over an existing Amerindian population, and that increasingly in Latin America, as here, there has been immigration from East Asia as well. There are more than 1 million people of Japanese ancestry in Sao Paulo. And of course, if you're from Sao Paulo and you're Japanese but speak Spanish, if you come to the United States, one possibility is that you'll be classified as Latino, whatever you look like, if you talk that way. So we've got this category, which is essentially a cultural and historical category, which we're desperately trying to cram into our old ways of racial thinking. And it's good, I think, that people should be reminded that however we think of the very, very diverse range of people who we call Latino or Hispanic, it doesn't make a lot of sense to think of them as defined by shared ancestry, because the only ancestry they all share is human ancestry.
Again, quoting Peter Beinart, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and wrote about the depiction of Barack Obama, something exotic, perhaps foreign. You know, the ads that we saw, the one, that one, and sort of those words replacing racial words in this campaign. But he also writes that if Martin Luther King Jr. was maybe a symbolic transitional figure as Americans accepted blacks, Barack Obama, whether or not he wins the office of president, may come to symbolize a new transition, that of the mixed race.
I think that's right. What's being drawn to our attention here is that the categories that we made in America, this Made in America category of black, and this Made in America category of white, are being burst by people's decisions to live together and to intermarry and so on. And I think as we sort of live more with that, one effect will not be to create a new category of mixed race people. It will be to reduce the importance of racial categories altogether in the way in which Americans think. And I'm not alone in thinking that that would be a very helpful move.
Well, and as you mentioned at the start, families who have children that they love that are of mixed race, it's an imperative.
It's a natural human thing. It's very hard to hate your grandchildren.
K. Anthony Appiah teaches philosophy at Princeton. His latest book is Experiments in Ethics. Professor Appiah, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us.
It's a pleasure. Very nice to talk to you, Robin.
On this note, for listeners in the Boston area, Anthony Appiah is being honored by Brandeis University. He'll be speaking there Monday afternoon. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And as Anthony said, there are a few Americans, not somehow, somewhere, connected to other races. And in the coming days, we have another story for you of the shared history between John McCain's white family and a black family in the South. John McCain's great-great-grandfather owned slaves in Mississippi. After the Civil War, two of those slaves took on the McCain name and rented land from their former owner, and the two McCain families, black and white, are still connected, as we're going to hear. Still ahead today, Googling the Earth to explore it. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sarah Palin describes herself as a Washington outsider, tired of that closed-door old boy network. But a report in this week's New Yorker magazine tells of a different Palin, a woman who not only got behind that closed door, but hosted the dinner party and wowed the old boys. Jane Mayer reported the story and joins us now. And Jane, how did Palin go about reaching out to Washington insiders?
Well, you know, there's sort of this myth that she came out of absolutely nowhere, but it's not really true. She's somebody who, according to John Bitney, who was her campaign advisor for the gubernatorial race, always had her eye on Washington, at least for a number of years. She's very ambitious, not unlike most politicians.
Right.
One of the things that I discovered that I thought was pretty amusing was that conservative political magazines have these cruises that go up to Alaska, among other places. The cruises stop in Juneau, where the governor's mansion is. And so Sarah Palin learned that these bigwigs from Washington, who were major pundits in Washington, very much the kind of the inside the beltway good old boys that she's made fun of, were actually going to be trooping through Juneau. And she was eager to entertain them at the governor's mansion.
Well,
and she connected in a way that was, you know, terrific for her own career there.
The first group to visit with Palin was Rupert Murdoch's staff of the Weekly Standard with conservative editor Bill Kristol. She hosted a lunch for them. Who else was there, and how did they react to her?
Well, there was also Fred Barnes, who was another writer for the Weekly Standard and a regular on something called the Beltway Boys in Washington, Fox TV show. And there was also Michael Gerson, who was the chief speechwriter for President Bush. They brought family members, and it was kind of a jolly affair, I think, in the governor's mansion. And at some point, Palin's daughter, Piper, popped in and asked about dessert. But they were completely charmed. What's very funny, when I interviewed these guys, is they seemed almost to have crushes on Sarah Palin. They kept talking about how good-looking she was and, you know, what a honey she was, or as Rush Limbaugh said, what a babe she was. I mean, so anyway, she wowed them, and she took them afterwards on a special helicopter tour to go up and take a look at a gold mine that's contested by environmentalists. And so, I mean, she really knocked herself out, you have to say, for those the good old boys of the inside the Beltway.
Well, and this isn't just your interpretation. I mean, William Kristol started referring to Palin as my heartthrob on Fox TV. This was, you know, sort of the drumbeat was increasing. Added to that, writers and editors for National Review, the magazine founded by William Buckley Jr., also took a cruise to Alaska. How important was that trip to Sarah Palin's political aspirations?
Well, I think it was very important. I mean, the first trip resulted in the first major article about Palin in the national press, and that was written by Fred Barnes. The second trip, though, had something else that took place, which is Dick Morris, who is a kind of an amazing political consultant. He's been a consultant to the Clintons. He's been a consultant to many conservative Republicans. He's kind of all over the place, and he's kind of a protean guy with so many different thoughts about how politicians ought to sort of cast themselves. He connected with Palin privately at this particular reception and told her that the most important thing was to maintain her image as an outsider. It was something that she was fascinated by. She then explained to the rest of the group what Morris had been telling her, and they kind of had this moment of, you know, important political connection, really, where she was getting advice from a super inside the Beltway pro about how to put herself forward. And obviously she took it to heart because she has been casting herself so much as an outsider, someone who doesn't understand Washington, wants to bring fresh air to Washington and throw out the good old boy network. But that network was, at least that part of the network that met with her in Juneau, was completely behind her.
Well, add to this, Sarah Palin and the state of Alaska in late 2007 hired a public relations firm with East Coast connections. In fact, it was based here in Massachusetts.
In Needham, that's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a young blogger based in D.C. started an online campaign for Palin in February of 2007. Who was he, and how important was he to drawing attention to Sarah Palin?
He's a very interesting young guy. I met with him in person here in Washington, and his name's Adam Brickley, and he's sort of a very conservative, very devout evangelical Christian, I guess you would call him. His whole family, actually, he was homeschooled, and his whole family converted to something called Messianic Judaism because they wanted to be like Christ, and Christ
Jewish.
Was a Jew.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, so he actually observes some Jewish holidays, just in really interesting, odd kind of niche that he's in religiously, but it's very important to him. And he did, believe it or not, he did a kind of a search on the web looking for women to run as Republican vice presidential candidates because he was afraid that Obama and Hillary Clinton were sort of sweeping away too much momentum on the Democratic side. And he went through all the women online, and he couldn't find anybody suitable. And then he thought, what about that lady who was just elected up there in Alaska? And so he started very early on a blog site pushing her. His enthusiasm spread through kind of a network of conservative internet sites from one to the next. And I think it was important in building momentum. Now, the thing is, what I tried to write about also was that Brickley, while he's very much an authentic single character, he's also the product of Washington in some ways. He's not from there. He's from Colorado. But he's received a lot of training and grants and help and direction from major Washington right-wing institutions, including right now he's living in kind of a dormitory that the Heritage Foundation in Washington runs.
And he was an intern for the Heritage Foundation.
He was an intern for them. He was trained by something called the Leadership Institute, which was founded by Morton Blackwell, who's kind of a right-wing Christian activist. They try to train these kind of young cadres on the right into how to take power.
So you have all this energy, a website, conservative columnist, Rush Limbaugh, and it's, you know, widely reported John McCain wanted to choose his longtime friend, Senator Joe Lieberman, but campaign advisor Charlie Black told McCain he might win if he picked Palin, he'd lose if he picked anyone else. So you had all of this energy. Of course, McCain picks Palin. Now you have William Kristol recently writing that John McCain should fire his entire campaign staff. You know, I'm wondering, are people having buyer's remorse?
Well, I mean, of course, right at this particularly tense moment in the election, they're not going to admit it inside the campaign. But they're smart people, and I think that, you know, they can read the polls. The polls are fascinating. They show that basically Palin gave McCain a great boost right after the convention, and now she is his greatest negative. Not only she herself, but the way he is seen to have made the decision about her has reflected poorly on his judgment in the view of many independent voters, if you take a look at the polls.
And what does all this say about Sarah Palin? Because I read your article and I think, wow, this is one smart, shrewd, ambitious woman who had a lot of guys wrapped around her pinky.
I think she is, and I don't think we've probably heard the last of Sarah Palin. You know, and the thing is, they were sort of cynically, I think to some extent, looking at her just for her resume. You know, female, yes, check, they liked that. Outsider to Washington, check, they liked that. Mother of five, they liked that. And good looking really mattered to them. Every one of these guys talks about how fabulous looking she was and how smitten they were, basically. So they were kind of thinking just having her fill a job because she looked good on paper. In truth, she's a real person and she's got big ambitions. I don't think she's maybe quite as easy to manipulate as they think she is.
Reporter Jay Mayer of The New Yorker. Her most recent article, The Insiders, How John McCain Came to Pick Sarah Palin. Jane, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
And always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Is Google making us stupid? That question was posed earlier this year by The Atlantic. The argument for was that we rely on having vast quantities of information at our fingertips, and with every fact just a Google away, we don't have to remember anything, so our minds are turning to mush. On the other hand, Google is also leading to new discoveries. Scientists in Germany used Google Earth to find that cattle and deer tend to align their bodies north-south when they graze. And scientists trace this to the Earth's magnetic poles. And now a group of archaeologists and anthropologists are using Google Earth to study areas that are either hard to reach or politically sensitive. Dr. Jason Ure is an anthropologist at Harvard University. He's been using Google Earth for some of his work. He joins us in the studio with a laptop with a fascinating photo on it. And Jason, let's remind ourselves, Google Earth displays satellite images of the Earth's surface. You can zoom in and out, look from a bird's eye view or other angles. For example, on your laptop screen, you've got, what is this? This is Turkey.
Well, right now we're looking at a valley in southeastern Turkey, and we're not just looking straight down, but we're actually looking at a vertical image that's been draped over the topography, which gives an amazingly realistic three-dimensional view, as if we were flying over top of this
valley.
Amazing.
And then go play with it. So here you're taking us over the ground. I'm a bird. I'm swooping down. Now you flip the image so I'm dive bombing it, but then you flip it up so I'm flying along the top of a river. And, of course, the photos aren't in real time. But how do you use these images for your work?
Well, the traditional image of archaeologists is people who dig small holes in the ground, but there's actually a lot to be learned about the past from what's on the surface. Very often vegetation grows differently on top of places where people used to live in the past, and that is what shows up from space.
For instance, take us to Syria, where you've been doing some work. We'll just fly over there.
Okay. I've been doing work with a Cambridge University project at the site of Tel Brak in what is today northeastern Syria. In the 4th millennium BC, this is one of the largest settlements on the planet. And the images that are shown in Google Earth have really helped us to find subtle traces of how humans changed the landscape surrounding the site.
Well, now we're looking at this. It's coming into focus. We see patchwork of land. It looks, you know, when you fly over the U.S., you see the different patches of farmland. It looks something like that. But in the center, you're zooming in on this area that is the site itself. What are you seeing there?
Well, in this case, we're looking at very subtle, slightly dark lines which radiate out from the site. Now, these features are ancient trackways. These would have been the paths that the inhabitants of this ancient city would have taken as they walked out to their fields, as they took their animals out to pasture, as they left the settlement. Now, today, these are under agricultural fields. The people that live there today have no idea they're there. They're not apparent from the ground. But from space, you can see them fairly clearly.
I'm thinking, too, that as a professor, you can teach with this. You can, you know, if you can't take everyone to Machu Picchu, you can show them things like that?
Well, that's one of the great things about this program is basically you can go anywhere in the world. My students can't all come with me to northeastern Syria, but we can do the next best thing.
Right. What's the downside, do you think, as an archaeologist, to knowing that these images are there?
Google Earth comes with an amazing ability to share information about places. And if we share too broadly, we are alerting people who maybe don't have the best interest of antiquity in mind. And so if we're not careful, we can give looters roadmaps to sites. And this has been a problem in archaeology, particularly in the Middle East since the most recent war in Iraq.
That's the problem with the internet. It is so open, but you worry that it might become too open.
Well, there's a fine line here for archaeologists. It's important for us to make the public interested in our research. On the other hand, if we give out too much information, in this case, precise locations to archaeological sites, which contain antiquities, we could be actually abetting in the destruction of exactly what we're trying to study.
But I'm wondering, too, do you at all worry that you'll have a new generation of armchair archaeologists who are like, well, why do I need to go? I can just Google Earth it.
Well, it's a bit difficult if you just have this satellite imagery. You are in orbit. You're not on the ground. Mm-hmm. We can find these sites, but we can't tell what the nature of settlement was. We can't tell when they were occupied. For that, we have to actually go to these places. So there's a limit to what you can do with this imagery, but it is a very powerful first start.
Dr. Jason Ure, an anthropologist at Harvard University, showing us how he uses Google Earth. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, acclaimed British sculptor Rachel Whiteread takes a doll's eye view of the world here and now. Welcome back. This week at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, a young boy and his dad pull aside a black curtain and enter the latest exhibit. Two 200 dollhouses, to be exact. They rise from the ground like a village on a hill. Two young women also stroll through and down memory lane.
It definitely takes me back because I had a dollhouse when I was a kid.
I did too.
My sister had like a Victorian one, and I had a country one.
Yeah.
This dollhouse community is called Place Village, and it's the work of acclaimed British sculptor Rachel Whiteread, who's long worked with themes of memory and home. Her 1990 piece, Ghost, was a plaster cast of an entire Victorian house that was like the one she grew up in. In 1993, she filled a house in London's East End that was about to be demolished with cement, then peeled away the walls and called the result simply House. In that same year, Whiteread became the first woman to receive Britain's prestigious Turner Prize. Oh, I had a chance to tour Place Village with Rachel Whiteread when she came to Boston to ready the houses. Can we go look at some of the houses?
Sure, yeah.
It felt both sweet and melancholy, because like that Twilight Zone episode where a man runs around an empty town, there is nobody home here.
I started collecting dolls' houses about 20 years ago, and I never really knew why. I just started buying them. After having done this for a number of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, I sort of stopped doing it. I was a bit disturbed by them. I didn't really know what they were. But gradually, I realised that it was the interior of these dolls' houses was the thing that really fascinated me, and the smell of them, and the way they were really like past lives, and families have played with them, generations of families have played with them. They get left in attics, and then eventually they've somehow came out on the open market, and I found them.
You really had no idea why you were collecting them?
Well, I mean, I knew that I was interested in them, but I was interested in the sort of sinister aspect of them. You know, you'd look inside them and kind of think, I wonder what happened in here. You know, in the way that, you know, you go to an old house and you open the door and sometimes it feels like a good place, other times it feels like a very creepy place. You know, every doll's house has its own sort of personality, and I think that directly comes from having been played with and used.
I was thinking you might have started to collect them in the way that many of us want to look inside someone else's home.
Yeah, I mean, it's always something that I've done as a kid. You know, I grew up in London, but, you know, it was in Victorian streets and you'd walk through and you're always peering through people's windows and seeing what they were up to. You know, there's no people in it at all. They're all empty.
Well, it's a ghost town. I mean, one of your pieces...
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's, you know, doors are ajar and lights are on. And, you know, the only thing that I really did to the dolls' houses was put electrics in all of them. That made little lampshades and, you know, so really kind of lit it as you might see... you know, a house in the wintertime as you drive through the countryside, or you fly into some peculiar airport in the middle of the night and look out the window and you'll see things like this, or you go to somewhere like Brazil and you look up in São Paulo and you see the favelas. And when I first made this piece, I showed it in a museum in Naples, and, you know, there's a whole history there of the Presepe and the kind of lit nativity scene. So it was sort of also kind of relating to that.
These modern-day mangers. Well, can we look at, inside
some? Sure, yeah. I mean, some of them have... This was actually one of the very first dolls' houses that I got, and inside it has this rather fabulous kind of fitted kitchen and...
Oh, yeah, with like a mock linoleum floor. This is a Tudor.
Yeah, sort of mock Tudor, yeah, and it has, you know, very detailed banisters and staircases, and, you know, this would have been completely handmade from scratch. And, you know, a lot of them have really wonderful furniture in them, which is the equivalent furniture of the age of the house.
But this is empty.
But I mean the fitted kitchen, you know, it's like this kind of 60s fitted kitchens that were, you know, this is from England, you know, post-war kind of mentality.
I'm just looking down through we have to get down low to look through. There's all the cabinets and the drawers in the kitchen kind of askew.
Yeah, and this is a rather fabulous bedroom. And as you look through there, you can see this piece. This is where the bed would have been, you know, so that's rather modern. And, you know, it's sort of people's fantasy houses, really. And there would be, you know, dad or granddad or possibly mum, you know, in the shed making these for their children for Christmas presents or whatever. So, you know, they're very much made out of love and passed down through generations, some of them.
What does this do for you to have this village here?
We start sort of at the beginning. The very first piece that I made was called Closet, and it was the cast of the inside of a wardrobe. It was cast in plaster, and then it was finally covered in black felt to make it feel like a kind of dark space. And, you know, so there's always this, there's this kind of anthropomorphic quality about a lot of things that I do.
Are you going to cast this village?
No, definitely not.
Let's walk over here to the west side of town, over here. Look at some. Did you have dollhouses when you were little?
We had one that my grandfather made that my sisters and I played with, fought over, I'd say, probably, rather than played with.
Well, I mean, is that a part of this? Because a lot of your work seems to be, and you've said some of it is about memory, or holding on to memories of homes, or trying to retrieve the memory of a home?
I'm sure that's a part of it. And, you know, when I showed this last time, which was at the Hayward Gallery in London, you know, a lot of people cried when they saw it, and which I was a bit disturbed by, because I didn't really want to be responsible for making people burst into tears. But quite genuinely, you know, you'd be waiting or standing in here and you'd hear someone come in and go, and it's quite strange to have that effect on. You know, I think often the thing, or some of the other things that I've made, like house, they're kind of awesome, and people are confused by them because it's almost like a house but isn't a house. And so I think there's something very emotive about something like a doll's house, where it just directly links to a very personal memory about childhood, which actually a lot of people sort of don't really go there.
Right. Well, you know, it taps into the same thing that happens, I think, when you're driving down the street and you see an old dollhouse put out at the curb for the garbage, and it has that sort of velveteen rabbit quality about it.
Yeah,
you know, it was loved and now it's not.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, one of the interesting aspects of collecting these has been buying them online. When they arrive, they either come with kind of funny notes in them, or, you know, sort of weird dated box of chocolates inside them, you know.
Well, what would the notes say?
Well, just, you know, my sister and I used to play in this. I've got no room to store it anymore. I'm really sad to let it go. And, you know, and then maybe they would have realised later on they'd seen the piece in the papers or something, and I'd get another note saying, oh, I was so happy to see that it's gone with this other, you know, all these other dolls' houses.
This is a darker one.
Yeah, this is a Quaker church, actually.
Oh, you can look in and see the pews.
Yeah. This actually did have an entire congregation made out of pipe cleaners and cotton.
Look at that.
Quite sinister. It was like something out of Salem.
The witch hunts.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know. I mean, I think it's up to the person who comes in here to sort of look in and see what they want to see in them, you know.